Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Welcome to Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson. On our program today, a crisis in the federal courts, the impact a shortage of U.S. District Court judges is having on our courts, and why many say politics is holding up the process. Retired federal court judge Oliver Wanger is here to answer our questions. A new study on air pollution, what the findings reveal about what's sending people to hospital emergency rooms. And are you ready for the next big quake, the big California shakeout? But first, the crisis in federal courts. Fresno has a new shiny federal courthouse, but not enough judges to handle what are the largest caseloads in the country. Despite the need, new judges are being confirmed at a snail's pace, leaving those on the bench overworked and a little frustrated.
Please rise. United States District Court for the Eastern District of California is now in session.
On any given day in the federal courthouse in downtown Fresno,
the Honorable Anthony W. Ishii presiding,
Chief District Judge Anthony Ishii could be hearing dozens of cases.
Please be seated.
Judge Ishii is currently one of two district judges hearing cases in the Fresno Division of the U.S. District Court's Eastern District, a sprawling area that stretches from the Oregon border to the Tehachapis in Kern County.
The district was created in 1966 with three judgeships. We got three more in 1978.
Since 1978, six judges have been handling thousands of cases in a court district which currently serves some 6.7 million people. The district is described as having the heaviest caseloads in the country, three times larger than the national average. Judge Ishii says the fact that the district is home to 19 of the 33 state and federal prisons located in California contributes to the overload.
From that prison population, we get a number of legal filings, whether they're writs or civil rights cases. 40% of our entire caseload is from the prisons.
The caseloads for Judge Ishii and U.S. District Judge Lawrence O'Neill, the two justices who hear cases filed in the Fresno Division, are about to get even larger.
Ever since Judge Wanger informally and now formally has announced his retirement, we've been trying to work out means of being able to address the caseload.
U.S. District Judge Oliver Wanger's last day on the bench was September 30th. By all accounts, the 70-year-old justice was a workhorse. His colleagues say he would sometimes try two cases at a time. Each of the justices were juggling a caseload of about 900 cases apiece. With Judge Wanger's retirement, the two remaining district judges can expect to get an additional 400 to 500 cases, a caseload they say will be impossible to handle.
Very frankly, and I have to be very candid about this, it's probably going to be virtually impossible. We're going to do the best we can on this. Ever since Judge Wanger informally and now formally has announced his retirement, we've been trying to work out means of being able to address the caseload.
Even before Judge Wanger's retirement, the heavily impacted federal court in Fresno already saw attorneys who try cases in the court searching for solutions.
One of the things we've had to do is shift our focus from federal court to state court. We file more actions in state court now than we used to years ago because we know that there's going to be a tremendous delay in federal courts.
Fresno attorney Willie Smith says getting civil cases through the court is already a long process.
It impacts us financially, and it impacts our clients financially because justice being delayed is, as they say, justice being denied.
Judge Ishii's predictions are just as dire. He says if new judges aren't added to the Eastern District soon, the courts may be forced to stop hearing civil cases altogether.
We're looking at that scenario, something that could well happen in our district, which is really totally unfair to the civil litigants and all litigants who have to be delayed simply because we just cannot handle all that caseload.
Joining me now to discuss the issue is retired U.S. District Court Judge Oliver Wanger. And Judge Wanger, let me say it's an honor to have you here this morning.
Thank you kindly and good morning.
Well, you know, it has been somewhat speculated that, you know, the grueling caseload and the failure of Congress to confirm new judges played some part in your decision to retire at this point.
It did to this extent. With it's, I think, closer to 1,800 cases per judge that Judges Ishii and O'Neill now are responsible for is a humanly impossible caseload. And by remaining there as a senior judge, which was in effect for no compensation, did not bring home to Congress what the reality of the workload is. They have ignored it year after year. Bar associations, civic groups, others throughout the United States have attempted to bring to the attention of Congress this crisis in the lack of judges, and it is without effect.
And it's not just the Eastern District. This is a nationwide problem, is it not?
Yes. Same conditions exist in Arizona, in Texas, in Kansas. And we have heard that as the new bill, Senator Feinstein has a bill that would bring four judges to the Eastern District that has just been reported out of the Senate and the Senate Judiciary Committee. We understand now that Senator Grassley, who is a longstanding enemy, quite frankly, of the federal judiciary, is making proposals that would make it, if legislation ever passes, unlikely there would be new judges before 2015, which essentially is irrational and destructive.
I mean, from everything that I have read and what you're saying this morning, the holdup in a lot of the confirmation of these judges is pure politics.
It is a political dysfunction. It is a political inability to do the job that we send Congress to Washington to do. There is no explanation except politics. And yet, how can a Congress that wants the law to be applied, who wants cases to be tried, and continues to pass laws that expand federal jurisdiction, how can they, in effect, defeat what their intention is as a legislature by not providing the judges who can do that job?
Okay. After hearing that, I'd love to have our listeners have an opportunity to ask the question to them. How do you feel about the fact that politics is holding up the judicial process, not only here in California, but across the country? You can call us at 559-275-8989 or 800-224-8989 or online at kvpr.org. Now, you know, I think I did read that the problem is especially tough in the Eastern District. I read that they last received a new judgeship back in 1990. That was a temporary position. So would it be fair to say that you were the last federal judge appointed and then confirmed in this district?
Actually, there have been replacement judges appointed and confirmed since me. I was confirmed in 1991. After that, Judge Burrell in Sacramento replaced a judge. Then Judge England replaced a judge. Judge Kim Mueller is our first woman federal judge in the Eastern District. She is the latest appointment. And we have John Mendez, who also replaced a judge. But again, the complement of judges is six judges for 7.6 million people. Last night, the new Supreme Court Justice, Justice Sacagawea was here and reminded us that in Los Angeles County, we have 10 million people. There are 600 judges. We have 7.6 million people. In this part of the district, the Fresno Division, 2.8 million people, two judges.
And they were, I think Justice Anthony Kennedy even said that you need at least 15.
He has said that. They're only asking for 4. That would give us 10. But it's not a bright prospect.
What does that say? I think also when it comes to our district, we hear about the process being political, but they've also said just because we are in the San Joaquin Valley, you know, we sometimes sort of lack that political clout even to maybe push and get some of these judgeships through.
There seems to be a lack of congressional focus on the Eastern District, but most especially the San Joaquin Valley. Here, as I think almost all citizens know, there are large issues with law enforcement, prison overcrowding issues in the local jails where we're going to have more prisoners coming back from the state system. We additionally have task forces that have focused on both laboratories, clandestine laboratories with controlled substances, large-scale marijuana grows where you have essentially foreign interests that are cultivating and operating these grows coming from Central and South America and Mexico. And essentially one of those programs, the High-Intensity Drug Task Force, which targets lags, I should say labs, and what we call the organized aspect of drug trafficking, they're not going to be able to do the job because they're gone. There's no money.
Right. Rosie from Fresno has a question for us now. Rosie?
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
My name is Rosie Andrews, and I work for the U.S. courts for 7 years. Now, I stay home with my kids, but I always stay involved in the subject. And I just wanted to let the public know and everybody know that the job that the U.S. District Courts are doing for our society is so important that I just cannot believe that our society and our Congress is ignoring how essential it is to serve justice in our society. They are as important as law enforcement agencies and service and hospitals. And without the U.S. courts, you know, you cannot take a case and make justice for so many people.
That's so true. Well, thank you, Rosie, for your comments.
Okay. Thank you. And good luck. And I hope our Congress, you know, in our society, can compensate and fund our cornerstone of our justice system.
That's so true. But, you know, we know now that we do, you know, there is a problem with our budget, but we're talking a situation that's been going on for decades. So you, at this point, I would say, Judge Wanger, you probably can't blame economics on this at all.
The judiciary has no constituency. In other words, they have no political influence and no political purchase when it comes to Congress. And the economics it would take the judiciary as a third co-equal branch of government makes up 0.1% of the entire national budget. That's the extent of the priority Congress gives to, quite frankly, doing justice in our nation.
We have Leonard from North Fork also has a question.
Yeah, good morning. Am I on? Hello?
Hello, go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, I got a ticket, and Wanger might remember me. I was before him, and he reversed my case, but it's a ticket for collecting firewood, and it's 261.H, if I remember correctly. And I was wondering if they would slow down on seeing all these revenue-generating cases with codes and statutes, you know, and reform that, maybe they could have more room for civil litigation instead of all these, you know, minuscule statutes and codes that the Forest Service and other branches of the government use the federal court systems for.
That concern needs to be addressed to the executive who enforces the law and not the judiciary. The judiciary simply handles the cases that are presented by the attorney general, who is the prosecutor for the United States. And so I understand your concern. The responsibility for those decisions is with the executive branch, not the judicial.
Exactly. But yeah, my whole point is that if they looked in more into it as a whole, you know, the community as a whole, into these what I consider revenue-generating statutes and codes, and reform it, I was just letting that out to the, you know, the public, to let them know that that would open it up for civil litigation as far as I'm concerned. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leonard, for calling in. But, you know, even with that, we still have a situation where we have civil cases, all kind of cases, just piling up. What are the majority of the kind of cases are you seeing right now?
Criminal cases represent over 60% on the docket. And in terms of cases that are being actively administered and tried, Judge Ishii spoke of the very large prisoner caseload. And because of the number of prisons, there are both habeas cases in which the decisions in state courts are being reviewed in federal court. And additionally, there are prisoner civil rights cases that focus on the conditions of confinement and other instances that occur while incarcerated, where these individuals bring cases to the federal court and ask for trials. And so they get in line with everybody else. The court tries the cases that are the oldest. The Civil Justice Reform Act for civil cases requires that a case be brought to trial within 3 years, that motions be decided within 6 months, and this district is impacted, and that is a concern that the public rightly has. As Willie Smith said earlier in this program, the more delay there is in cases, cases are not like wine. They don't get better with age.
Well, you know, what about the situation also that Judge Ishii mentioned? He said it did happen in San Diego for a while, that they did have to stop hearing civil cases. With the caseload that these two judges have, even though they do have help, with the caseload they have, is that something we could see in the Eastern District?
It appears to be more likely than not that civil trials may be essentially put on hiatus for a period of time, because although they do have help, and there are Article I judges, magistrate judges that prepare findings and recommendations, and there are law clerks to help the judges, it is only one judge who takes the bench and has to make the decisions in literally 100 cases a week. Mm-hmm. And these are cases that some of them are huge. They are complex, as, for instance, the water cases that we've talked about before that have gone on for 30 years and more. And there is no easy answer, and there is no way that one judge times two can handle 3,600 cases.
You know, that was my next question. So you look at some of the high-profile cases that you heard in your court, you know, challenges to the Endangered Species Act, Operation Rezone, the suit brought on behalf of Fresno's homeless. You know, what does it take to handle a case like that? You just said something going on for 30 years and with so few judges. How can you do this?
Our decisions, for instance, in water cases, there have been almost 100 of those cases in my court, and they've been going on before, they're going on now, and will go on after I'm gone. Those decisions result in hundreds of pages. Thousands of hours a year are spent on those cases. The Fresno homeless case required about 3 weeks of intense work in the injunctive stage, where discovery, court hearings, and then a decision had to be prepared. It's hour intensive. And again, not to say this personally, but my average work week was 70 to 80 hours a week, not because I like that, but because That's what it took at a minimum to do the job.
How did you find the time? When you say that, 70 to 80 hours a week.
That means every night and every weekend, and nights on the weekends as well, to be prepared for a Monday calendar and then trial starting on Tuesday.
And the other judges were having to have similar schedules as well. You can only keep that up for so long.
Yes. And Judge Ishii and Judge O'Neill are laboring under the same conditions. They're simply impossible conditions, and yet they're powerless, as the third branch of government is powerless, because only the legislature has the power to tax and spend, and to spend means to provide the resources, one, fund the courts, and all of government agencies are being cut. So even if the courts aren't funded, to not provide the judges that are needed essentially means the justice system cannot operate.
You know, even if they started confirming these judges, we have such a huge backlog. It will take some time.
There's no question that the accrued cases and the cases that are in the system are going to have to be decided on a time priority basis. But the law also gives priority to certain kinds of cases, like injunctions, like criminal cases have to be tried within a Speedy Trial Act and the constitutional right to a speedy trial. That means that other cases that are rightly in line and are getting older simply continue to wait, primarily civil cases.
Any solution to this problem? You're talking about something that is politically driven. What can be done?
The only solution that, and I don't think it's a solution, it is a stopgap at best, is based on the public spirit and the commitment of other judges in the Ninth Circuit, judges from Montana, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, Arizona, Guam, and the American Protectorates have come to the Eastern District to help. 70 judges took cases, prisoner cases, to help us. But again, that's stretching already thin resources, where we're robbing Peter to pay Paul by taking judges away from their home courts to come here to help.
You know, this problem, unfortunately, won't get resolved soon, but you have retired and you're going into private practice. What kind of cases are you going to be handling, and what is it that you're looking forward to?
I'm
probably spending time with your family.
That is true, and that's already happened. We have a change where we were able to get to the fair on Saturday evening. I'm going to do three basic things. The first is some private judging, meaning arbitration and mediation. I'm going to continue to be and return to being a trial lawyer on the other side of the bench in the courtroom. I plan on doing some pro bono work in addition to work for private clients. And I'm going to provide services as an expert witness, having spent a long time teaching the law as well as being a lawyer and a judge.
Well, you surely are a valuable asset to the community. And from what I've read, you've always given back and given your time to other young law students. We talk about politics a lot, but could we see that in your future?
That is something I have never considered. And because of the Hatch Act, which makes it illegal for federal judges to engage in any kind of political activity, it was far beyond my contemplation.
But now, and you know what I think it is? I think people look at, the gridlock that we have in Congress, and they look at the fact that nothing is getting done. And I think most of the public, when it comes down to whoever it is who represents them and whatever party, they would like to have somebody who believes in getting the work done.
And I quite agree. We have 100 senators and well over 500 in the House of Representatives, and it takes a majority or a supermajority in each House, meaning like-minded people who care about the public, who care about doing the business of the public and the work of Congress. And as long as political concerns dominate and exclude the efficient or even the effective operation of Congress, unfortunately, it's now business as usual, even such things as approving the budget for the United States annually cannot be done without making it a crisis, doing it at the last minute, and again, all to the detriment of the public who are hurting nationwide in what are severely impacted adverse economic conditions.
Is there the possibility, when you look at it, we talk about Congress, because all of the actions from not confirming judges to not doing a budget on time, it does impact the public. And the public is letting them know that, but it seems like it stops, you know, before it gets to Washington. There seems to be a disconnect.
Again, I have as much information as you do about that, but what I observe is that there seems to be great interest and strong emotion nationwide in the public, quite frankly, who Congress serves, to have effective results. And somehow when the political process operates business as usual, nothing gets done.
Well, for you, when you look back on your career as a justice, what is the case that really will always be with you?
Well, there are so many cases, but obviously the water cases, given the import and what is going to happen to our state if some kind of physical and scientific solution is not reached to balance the needs of the environment against the need for our society to use water. We can't exist without it. Equally important was the Fresno homeless case. Here was essentially the failure to read the law and to know the law to, without notice, accept that you had to be out and pick up your property, but the property of those who were present where they shouldn't be, and there wasn't a question about that, and there was no argument that there was trespassing. But even if you're charged with a criminal offense, you don't seize and destroy property. Under the Fourth Amendment, you have a right not to have an unlawful seizure. You either get a pre-deprivation or a post-deprivation hearing, and here the ashes that were in an urn, a brand-new bicycle, somebody's false teeth, their identity documents were simply put into a compactor and destroyed on the spot, and that was the end of it. And so that was a case where essentially we found that the Constitution is alive and well.
Okay. Well, we will have to end on that, and I'd like to thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for your years of service, and we are looking forward to the future with you.
Thank you very much, and it's very good to see you again.
The retired U.S. District Court Judge Oliver Wanger. You are listening to Valley Edition, and we'll be right back.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Renita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Earlier this summer, the Valley was slapped with $29 million penalty for violating the federal ozone standard. We also saw a week when the Valley Air Pollution Control District issued alerts, the air being so bad that kids couldn't go out and play. Well, the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State is out with a new study today looking at bad air days and emergency room visits. With us today to discuss those findings is Dr. David Lighthall, Health Science Advisor with the Air Pollution Control District, and Dr. John Chipman, Capitman, Executive Director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute. Now, Dr. Lighthall, on this study, now, did Dr. Capitman head up this study?
Yes, he did, and the Valley Air District was very happy to fund that study. And another research partner that played an important role was Tim Tyner at UCSF Fresno.
Okay. And basically, what was the purpose of the study?
Well, we have to make the decisions all the time about controlling sources of pollution in the valley. And as I think everyone understands, we have a real cross to bear in the fact that our geophysical environment, our climate, tends to concentrate pollutants. So we have to go further in terms of controls, like our wood rule, where we ask people not to burn on many nights during the winter. But we never had the kind of blue ribbon epidemiological study that we saw in Southern California, that we've seen in the northeastern United States, and in the industrial Midwest. And so it was really important. It's really important that our decision makers, when they make tough decisions, when they ask the public, when they ask businesses to go that extra mile, that we actually have evidence from the valley, not a study in Southern California, not a study in the Bay, but a really well-designed epi study here in the valley.
Okay. I understand Dr. Kappenman is now joining us. In this study, what did you all look at?
Yeah. Hi. Good morning. Thank
you. Good morning.
We looked at data for hospitalization and emergency room for selected respiratory and cardiovascular diseases, in particular asthma. And then we looked at how rates of using hospital or ER varied from day to day and correlated that with the level of air pollution on each day.
And thus far, both of you can talk about this. Why did you choose that? You were saying, Dr. Lighthall, I think, why you decided to look at that particular data.
Well, that's really the most compelling evidence. It's the most compelling way to use a process of statistical inference to look at correlations. And John, I'll let you go ahead and respond to that as well.
Sure. Well, you know, Juanita, there's a lot of data from around the world that compares communities or regions to regions and looks at how air pollution affects health. And that tells you something about the long-term consequences of air pollution. One of the big questions is within the valley, where and in other regions, where the level of air pollution varies from day to day. How do spikes in air pollution, how does worse air affect the health of people? Very, very hard to sort out how the valley compares to the rest of the world in terms of health conditions and other kinds of health problems and the health system, and all of that gets reflected in those long-term impacts. But the short-term impacts, what we studied here, is probably the best single way to get at how our variations in air quality day-to-day impacting us in the region.
Like, for instance, this summer when we had that spike mm-hmm. in air pollution throughout the valley, and there were air alerts. In a situation like that, that's what you would be looking at when maybe more people might be showing up in emergency rooms.
Exactly, except that we found very troubling that when the air gets to that yellow zone, the moderate zone, that's when we start to see more people using the emergency room.
So it's not necessarily when it's at its worst.
Yeah, it's not necessarily when it's worst. It's when we get out of the good zone and start to be in air, the kind of days where the air board or where the news says it's concern for sensitive conditions or moderate air quality. Those are days already where we should be concerned.
And can I just interject here? I think it's also important for the public to understand there's a big distinction between summertime ozone and the intensity of health effects from that summertime ozone and wintertime PM2.5 or fine particulates. What John is mentioning is that for the wintertime, for the fine particulates, the study found that at around 30 micrograms average 24-hour pollution, we did see elevated emissions for PM2.5. We did not see that for ozone, but the – so that's the relative sensitivity of asthmatics to air pollution is really very apparent in the wintertime.
Could that be because of, I mean, we do have policies in place now, but when you talk about, you know, wood burning and fireplaces and that sort of thing, that puts those small particulates in the air.
Exactly. We have another whole sets of scientific bodies that look at clinical evidence and experimental evidence. We know what the bad actors are within this fine particulate. There's a number of different chemicals. Ozone is just a single compound. It's homogeneous. It has fairly well-defined effects. This other PM2.5 is really more of a mixture of very biologically active chemicals, much of it based on the burning of hydrocarbons, whether it's wood, whether it's a diesel, whether it's gasoline, or burnt oil.
So what does this mean for the public, people who have asthma and other health problems, that on days when the air quality is being called moderate, even at that level, it's really sending people to the hospital?
That's right. I think that for people who have asthma, there are a number of recommendations that health professionals make. The first is just to be aware of the air quality and to be aware when it's going to be a bad air day. And on those days, asthmatics should make whatever effort they can to avoid being outside, make sure that their medications are up to date.
And, Dr. Lightoll, you, from what I see now, you are now an advisor with the Air Pollution Control District. Are we getting any closer, any better to doing something mm-hmm. about our bad air?
I think it's really important. I'm going to mention two things. In 2008, the board voted in the second generation of our wood controls. And that put a limit, asked people, in fact, required people not to burn wood in their homes in the major metro areas and other cities in the valley itself when the predicted level was 30 micrograms. Okay, now that's in the yellow zone that we've been talking about, the moderate zone. So we, in fact, are asking the public, demanding of the public not to burn in that area below the daily standard, which is 35 micrograms. So that's the toughest rule in the country. So that's an example where we have actually made a measurable improvement on wintertime air quality. And I think people who live in Fresno and other cities have noticed over the past 6 years, things have gotten a lot cleaner in the evening. Now, we still have a long ways to go. We have a lot of old smoking vehicles. We have a lot of people driving pre-1976 vehicles with no catalytic converters. I just was behind a Fresno Unified School bus, which I could smell for a number of blocks. We have still a lot of these chemicals floating around, and it's not just in the wintertime. Much of this is motor vehicle exhaust. The California Air Resources Board is moving fairly ambitiously to control those, at least from diesel trucks. But, we have a problem with our fleet of both heavy-duty and light-duty vehicles.
Yes, they do. They're working on them, but
and
it is a slow process.
I think it's also important for people to understand that we have all these people sensitive to allergens. We have these chemicals from hydrocarbon burning that we know is a problem. And here we have a tremendous amount of exposure that's coming from lawn care. It's completely unregulated. We have leaf blowers kicking up all sorts of allergens. They're spewing lots of ultrafine particles from the combustion of the engines. And we are having children walk in and out of those different kinds of plumes. So they're getting hit by the bioaerosols, the allergens. At the same time, they're getting hit from very high concentrations of ultrafine particles from the engine combustion. So that's something that we are working on. We're going to have a conference in May 21st of next year to look at how we're going to get ourselves get this lawn care sector under control.
Well, the effects of air pollution on the health of Valley residents, it's well documented. We know about the high rates of asthma, lung and heart disease. Do you think are we to the point where, because it's been such a problem here, that maybe too many people are accepting of it? They just think, well, we've got bad air. We even know on bad air days, and when they tell people to stay inside, you still have people going about their regular activities. Are we in danger of that because it's such a part of our lives here in the Valley?
I do not think so. I think people are very concerned. And I think that it's important to recognize that the study validates the controls that have already been taken by the air district, such as the Wood Rule and CARB's controls on motor vehicles. If we hadn't been ratcheting back on these pollution levels, things would be a lot worse. So what this does is it tells us that if we keep working, we keep reducing pollution, we're going to have proportional reductions in health effects.
Dr. Kaplan, what are they planning to use the results of this study for?
Well, we hope these results can add to an ongoing effort to raise public awareness. David spoke to that. I think that people are aware that we live in an air basin with problems with particulate matter and ozone, and yet I don't think there's the level of public outrage and engagement and decision-making and discussion that's needed. So we hope, first of all, that this kind of study really continues to increasing public communication about the risks represented by air pollution and continuing our attention to what we can do as individuals and as a community to address that problem. So I think that that's the first most important use of the data. Like all good researchers, I'm struck by the questions we haven't answered here, and there really are some important ones. We do not know what it is about the health system that and how we take care of people with asthma and other health conditions that seeks to minimize their responsiveness to these bad air days or to mitigate the impact of that. And so there's a lot of work to do about how can we maximize the effectiveness of healthcare in working with people with asthma and other conditions. So I think that that's a second area. And I think a third area of work and something that David Lighthall just referenced is the importance of understanding more about what is in the particulate matter, that PM 2.5, the fine particulate matter, what is that consist of, and how do the different components of it influence our health, and what are the implications then of understanding those particular components for policy and practice?
Okay. And you were saying, and I know Dr. Lighthall, you will have to leave in a few moments, but what does this mean for the Air Pollution Control District and the work that they're doing? You mentioned that we already see some positive results from some of the rules and regulations they've put in effect. So as we do more research and more study, we get more information and ways to start to try to manage this problem.
Yes. I think that the study is a really good marker to help the district guide its development of state implementation plans for PM 2.5, which is going to be a big project here for 2012. What it tells us is that we're going to have to go further. We're going to have to ask more sacrifices from business. We're going to have to ask more sacrifices from households. I mentioned the lawn care sector. I mentioned that we still have a lot of what's known as gross polluting vehicles. We have a lot of school buses that need to be replaced. Part of this is just trying to come up with funds to provide incentives for schools. But I think a really important part, and I would like to really invite the, you know, the health advocates and the environmental community, environmental justice community, to really engage in a dialogue with the district when we develop this 2.5 plan. Because we actually know quite a bit about why we're seeing these high levels, you know. And again, this study really underscored what John just talked about. It's a certain set of chemicals, and it's also bioaerosols. We also have to understand that there's mold, there's pollen, there's endotoxin. these are things floating around in our air that aren't controlled, per se, by the air district. They're not considered, quote, anthropogenic. But they're an important reason why we see such high levels of asthma. And you imagine these people that are responding to these bioaerosols, and then the chemicals are actually increasing their sensitivity to the allergens, to the mold, to the pollen, and so forth.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Lighthall. And before we continue, I'd like to invite the public. We want to hear what you think about the asthma rates here in the Central Valley and what's being done to help people with these problems and also to clean up our air. You can give us a call at 559-275-8989 or 800-224-8989 or online at kvpr.org. Now, Dr. Kappenman, you were saying that you still think that the public somehow needs to be engaged more in this whole process and this whole fight.
Yeah, I do believe that. I think that people know that air pollution is a challenge in the Valley, but I don't think we're thinking about it on a daily basis. What are the risks associated with the choices that I make each day? How am I exposed, and what is it I can do? And I think that there would be a lot more excitement, support, backing of the efforts that are pushing for clean air as people become more aware of the health risks involved.
And as you mentioned, Dr. Lighthall, you were talking about one of the things you were really talking about is the small particulate, the small particulate matter. That is a huge problem here for so many people.
Yes, it definitely is. And it's not just a wintertime problem. And I think we also have to understand that there's a whole set of particles known as ultrafine particles that are way smaller than what we're talking about with 2.5. And these are very efficient at penetrating deep into the lungs and delivering those chemicals. They have a lot of surface area. They're very efficient. And we know that if someone's out exercising, they're actually absorbing 4.5 times more. This is one of the reasons why we have created a real-time air advisory network where individuals, and especially sensitive individuals, go to our website, valleyair.org, look at RAAN, RAN, Real-Time Air Advisory Network. You can sign up and you will automatically receive an email or a text anytime air quality enters into the orange or unhealthy for sensitive group. So we do have this system. We spend a lot of effort. It's designed for schools, but it's also available to the general public.
And we have, is it Mr. Carr? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you have a comment about our air quality?
Yes, I do. The wood-burning law is only in effect in wintertime for a few months, and that doesn't help the people in our neighborhood. When we have a neighbor who is burning throughout the summer, even when it's 80 degrees. And I was told to go to board meetings to present my case to people, to try to get to talk to people on the board. And that would take 3 to 5 years to change a simple law and make it year-round. The wood-burning law should be year-round because when we called numerous neighbors called air quality control, we could not get help because they have there's no law to give them the bite to go and talk to the guy and get him to stop.
Why is he burning? What is he burning?
Well, I don't know what he's burning, but we can smell it in our house. It makes us sick.
And
sure smells like wood. And
okay. We've
talked to him and he consistently burns. He's not going to stop.
I'd like you to follow up and call me at the Air District. My name's David Lighthall. And
David.
You can get a hold of me there.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Karen. We appreciate your call. Also, we have Obi from Sanger.
Hello?
Yes. Your call, please. Your question?
Yes. I just wanted to ask your panelists there, what percentage of the pollution in the Fresno and Foothill area here do you think migrates in on winds from the west to the east, from the Bay Area, San Francisco, the Bay Area, and higher population areas? What percentage comes from out of the area to our area?
This is primarily a summertime phenomenon when we have the winds that come in through the Carquinez Strait and then move down the valley. So for summertime ozone, we get the estimation, I think, is maybe in Stockton, it's about 23% of their ozone precursors are coming from the bay. Further down in Fresno, it's maybe down to around 14%, and then maybe down to around 9% in Bakersfield. So most of it's homegrown, especially in the wintertime. We're not getting importation of pollution from other regions in the wintertime for the most part. In fact, we export PM2.5 to the Bay Area during the wintertime.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and that is one thing that we hear a lot of. People, we've heard that, oh, we're getting pollution from the Bay Area.
We are getting pollution from the Bay Area. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, we help force them to meet the same smog control standards that we have here in the valley. We're also getting pollution from Asia. I mean, we're sponsoring a study by UC Davis to take a look at that. And so most of it, though, I think it's important for people to understand, especially the PM2.5. It's what's being generated in your city. It's what's being generated on your highway. It's what's being generated in your neighborhood.
Wow. Well, thank you both for coming in this morning. And you are releasing the study today. So we will look for that. Thank you, Dr. John Kappenman, Executive Director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute, and Dr. David Lighthall, Health Science Advisor at the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Today, some 8.4 million people in California are participating in one big earthquake drill. It's called the Great California Shakeout. And here to talk with us about this event is Susan Jacaro, the host of Totally Unprepared on KPBS in San Diego. Thank you, Sue, for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Juanita.
Well, you know, how do you help people prepare for the big one, as they call it?
Well, I am a host of the Totally Unprepared web campaign and PBS show, and we go into people's homes and we show them how they can better prepare for an earthquake. So not if an earthquake happens, they can recover more quickly and they don't have to worry about as much if
so,
they didn't prepare. So my job is to do it in a fun and entertaining way, and hopefully, you know, if I can just get one person to change their mind and prepare, then I feel like I've done my job.
Okay, and I think we have a clip, don't we, of exactly what you do to try to help people prepare, and we're going to listen to that now.
Hey, it's Susan Jacaro from TotallyUnprepared.com. I'm standing on the shake table at University of California, San Diego, where scientists can recreate the motion of an earthquake on this hydraulic platform. It's used to test models and structures to see how well they hold up against the forces of an earthquake. Pretty cool, huh? Today we're here to answer a very important question from Fred Von Lohman of San Francisco.
Will it shake?
What happened to my wine rack in an earthquake?
Wow! Wow!
Okay,
yes, so the wine rack didn't fare too well.
And so that's what he was concerned about. And I do want to correct one thing, that the big shakeout is on October 20th.
Yes,
and this
yes.
is something that it takes place across the state. People participate in it all at the same time, correct?
Yes, and we have the most people signed up this year. We get a million more people every year, it seems, which is fantastic. So, yeah, we're at 8.4 million right now. And, yes, this Thursday at 10:20 a.m. all over California, and actually about 200,000 people outside of California even have signed up.
to take part, we're going to all drop cover and hold. So we're going to do an earthquake drill together.
Well, you know, people here in California grew up as kids with, you know, the drop and roll. Do you think we have to do more now? I mean, we've all seen some pretty devastating quakes, and
yeah.
Scientists are telling us that it really is just a matter of time for portions of California. So this is really a serious matter. I understand trying to make it fun and keeping people involved, but they also need to take away the information that you're trying to give them.
Oh, definitely. I mean, what is more precious than your own life or the life of your loved ones? So it's so simple. Drop, cover, hold. It's very easy to practice. It's very easy to drill. You can do it wherever you are. I think it's really funny right now. There's tons of people taking pictures of themselves planking, you know, and that's kind of a thing that's going on. And drop, cover, hold is just as easy, and you can get that out in all different sorts of social media. So I would really hope that people take this little bit of information and take it to everybody that they love and they care about.
Well, what are some of the major hazards that we see in the home?
Definitely a lot of people get too close to the windows with the broken glass. So there's a lot of foot wounds, bleeding, things that fall on people's heads. You have a lot of head wounds. It's a little bit shocking because head wounds tend to bleed a lot. So taking a first aid class would be super helpful, kind of gets you in mind of what could occur and what steps you can take to prevent that. But even better, if you take all the heavy stuff off the top of your bookshelves and put them on the ground, then you don't even have to worry about getting a head wound. If you put a little earthquake putty behind some paintings, you don't have to worry about paintings falling down or photographs glass breaking. You secure your stuff in your kitchen, you don't have to worry about things spilling out. Kitchens tend to be a really dangerous place during and after an earthquake because so many things will fall out and break, and then they're all over the ground. So it's very easy. It's very, very easy to get prepared for an earthquake.
How do you think having a statewide event can help motivate people to make sure they are prepared?
I think it's great because a lot of people start talking about it. And as soon as you get communication, that's a lot of the battle. I'm really excited to see that so many people are joining in this year. I mean, 8 million people, that's not a lot. Here, I'm over in Los Angeles, we have 3 million people signed up. It's great. I think we have 1.3 maybe people signed up around San Francisco, so I would like to see a lot more people signing up in that area. It's just as soon as people talk about it, then people are aware of it, and the more people are aware, we have a better chance of people getting prepared.
And you also have a group of people here in the Valley who are participating as well.
I would hope so, most definitely.
Okay. And you have a website for people who want any more information. I think it's www.totallyunprepared.com. That's for you, not for the shakeout, correct?
Yes, and we have webisodes there. We also have free downloads in case you want to put an emergency kit together, tons of information. We would love, love, love for people to go there and just learn what they can.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Susan Jacarl. With Totally Unprepared. Thank you for joining us this morning.
All right. Stay safe.
Oh, we will. Thanks for the advice.
All right.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.